Welcome to the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM. We're talking hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, climbing, diving, and whatever else you can get up to outdoors. Here's your host of the VOCM Outdoor Hour, Leslie Ann Corrigan.
Welcome back for another adventure on the Outdoor Hour. That's right, I am your host, Leslie Ann Corrigan. And over the past few weeks on the show, I've been revisiting some previous guests to catch up with them post-pandemic. I feel like we're on the way to post-pandemic, I should say. I shouldn't get ahead of myself, I guess, especially with things so serious as this. But here in Newfoundland especially, we seem to be on our way out of what was a long tunnel. And it's nice to catch up with people to see how they've fared throughout this and what has changed and what has remained the same. So on today's show, it's one of those things where I'm kind of coming back to a topic that I talked about previously, but this topic is very much in the news lately. And just wanted to use this show as an opportunity, as I've done in the past, and I keep talking about it, it's a phrase I use over and over again, to shine a light. And I use this show to shine a light on the people and the organizations and the businesses that are operating in the outdoor industry, who work every day to conserve and harvest natural resources and to protect and enjoy the environment that those resources are available in. And we're so lucky to have a wonderful array of outdoor activities and resources that we can harvest and enjoy here in Newfoundland and Labrador. One of those major ones, the king of all game fish, of course, is known as the Atlantic salmon. And you've heard it in the news lately. It's definitely a hot button topic. So I wanted to revisit one of my previous guests from the Atlantic Salmon Federation, Steve Sutton, to get his take on this, and also to bring in one of our local organizations that has been working for so long to conserve and protect the environment and the stocks of the Atlantic salmon. And so we're also going to be joined by Bob Bishop of the Salmonid Association of Eastern Newfoundland. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Well, thanks again for joining us again, Steve. I guess we'll start with you, since you're used to this whole process and you're well-versed in how we do things here. It's very casual chat here on the Outdoor Hour, but I really do want to thank you for joining us again. So tell us about the Atlantic Salmon Federation, in case people didn't catch the show previous. Tell us a little bit about just generally what you guys do.
Well, we are, as the name says, the Atlantic Salmon Federation. Our ultimate goal, the reason for existing, is to protect and conserve wild Atlantic salmon for the people who care about them and depend on them.
Right. So, and that would include recreational anglers, people who fish for sustenance for food, I guess, the limited opportunities that we have to do that here, but also the industry built around the Atlantic salmon. That's right, I guess.
Yes, and indigenous peoples as well, who have very close connection to wild salmon.
Absolutely. And so, Bob, your organization, the Salmonid Association of Eastern Newfoundland and Labrador, is similar in mandate. You have been working tirelessly for many years to protect the environment that salmon and trout live in, and this resource that we all use and love and respect.
Yes, we have. Same. We usually just call ourselves same because it's a lot easier and often provokes the joke about being insane. But we were founded in 1979 because through the 70s and right up until in 78, 79, salmon stocks in the province had declined dramatically from where they had been. And Sane here on the East Coast and Spawn on the West Coast were formed at the same time for the same reason, because of the declines in stocks, but essentially to work as ASF does on a larger scale to conserve, protect, and enhance salmon stocks in Newfoundland and Labrador. Over time, we found that we were getting more and more people, members, and some board members as well, whose primary interest was trout. So to be a bit more inclusive, we changed the name to Salmonid to take in both trout and salmon of Eastern Newfoundland. But we've worked on a lot of projects over the years. We worked with local people in St. Mary's Bay to create a new salmon run on the Rocky River. We were heavily involved in the early days of restoration and enhancement of salmon runs on the Exploits River, areas above Grand Falls. We were heavily involved in that. We've done some work more recently reintroducing salmon into the Rennies and Virginia Rivers here in St. John's. We've done a lot of work on volunteer work in, you know, introducing new people to fly fishing, fly tying, and so on. And we do that, you know, right up till now. Even on a socially distanced basis, we've been trying to get our fly tying classes going again for children and adults.
Mm-hmm. And I know one story that I really loved reading about and watching videos on some time ago was the program that you guys started with new Canadians and to teach them some basics of fly fishing. I thought that was great.
Yeah, we just thought that would be a good way to an introduction to an aspect of Newfoundland life that typically is missed by you know, most programs to introduce people to Canada and the things that we do and so on. Mm-hmm. And we just thought that would be like a nice Newfoundland touch.
Definitely would be, and it's always great to welcome people into your hobby and your passion and new Canadians coming in to see what we do here and actually getting a hands-on feeling from experienced fishermen. I wonder if they know how lucky they are. I would love to have some casting lessons from some of you guys. You're pros, for sure. So, Steve, we'll circle back with you now because I do want to talk, like, the theme of this past few weeks on the Outdoor Hour has been sort of circling back. So I want to come back to you and the hot button issue that we've been talking about so much in the news lately has been catch and release. And the whole point of this show is to get the facts out there and the data out there. And both of your organizations have been working to raise money to fund projects on conservation, but also ASF does a lot of work with research and that sort of thing. So I wanted to really dig into the data here on today's show and ask you some sort of point blank questions that we can draw from this research that's been done for years and years, not just by ASF, but by hundreds of different organizations around the world. So catch and release is on the tips of everyone's tongue these days. Has catch and release ever been proven to cause widespread fish mortality?
Well, that's the ultimate question there, and I think to answer that question, you have to realize that catch and release is a tool, one of the tools that we have for managing salmon populations, and part of the issue is how you use that tool. So, when the tool is used in the proper way, and people are doing it correctly, the scientific evidence overwhelmingly from the salmon world, research done throughout Canada and Europe on salmon shows that the mortality is very low. There will be a chance every time you hook a salmon and release it. There's always a chance that something will go wrong and it won't survive. But overall, that chance can be lowered to a very acceptable level. So in that case, you know, of course, catch and release will not lead to widespread mortality of salmon. If you use it as a tool improperly, if it's not regulated, if it's you know, done wrong, if it's done in water temperatures that are too high, well, of course, you'll expect to get higher mortality. But we can manage those things. We can regulate those things. So in general, no, you would not expect catch and release to lead to wide-scale mortality based on the science that's out there, and there's a lot of it.
There is a lot of science out there. Bob, I know that you've been referencing a lot of this science over the past few weeks in your discussions with other groups and other media outlets on. You know, in your opinion, you were, you know, you're an actual biologist. I learned before the show, a fisheries biologist. You worked in the field for several years. In your experience, has, you know, catch and release ever been something that has helped salmon stocks, has improved salmon stocks? Do you think that's something that we could extrapolate from this data?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're going to have to go overseas just to have one really good example. You know, totally different situation in terms of ownership and of resources and so on. But, you know, if you look at the River Dee in Scotland, it's about 87 miles long. excuse me. And it's all privately owned by 40-odd different organizations or private individuals. 20-odd years ago, that river was in serious trouble. And all the owners of fishing rights on that river got together and created the Dee River Fisheries District Fisheries Board. And they agreed amongst themselves that there would be absolutely 100% catch and release on that river. That was 22, 23 years ago. And what you've got to realize is that for those people, that's a business asset. The fishing rights were a business asset. And what they did was they went 100% catch and release with the expectation that they would lose some of their customers because people want to take a fish home, and that's quite understandable, but they thought it was the proper thing to do in order to protect the value of their asset. And after 22 years, they have been delighted with the results. Their runs are much stronger. Their highs are higher. Their lows are still much higher than adjacent rivers and so on, and they are still 100% behind catch and release. And they haven't lost their customers. People still want to go there and fish because they know they're going to have the opportunity to catch and release beautiful fish.
Right, absolutely. We're going to talk more about what is the draw of fishing just to release, and I think that's some question that we often get, and I'd like for your guys' take on that. So we're going to be right back after this break on the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.
Now let's get back to the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.
And we're back on the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM. I'm your host, Leslie Ann Corrigan, and we're talking catch and release this week. I guess no one's surprised that that's the topic that I chose for this week. It is definitely very much on the minds and on the airwaves and in the news stories all over the province this week. We are being sort of challenged on this, and every now and then it's good, I think, to be challenged and to hear other people's opinions and concerns. But at the end of the day, I also think it's important to rely on data and research and impartial science that's been done in any field and any controversial thing, and that's basically what we're doing today. I've brought in a couple of organizations who fund and who also conduct their own research and science into all sorts of things that are happening and affect the Atlantic salmon. So I've got the Atlantic Salmon Federation, Dr. Steve Sutton is joining us, and Bob Bishop from SANE. Thank you, Bob, for allowing me to call you SANE, because Salmonid Association is always something I have to think about when I say. But I've got the gentleman here. We are talking about catch and release. Before the break, we sort of laid it out on the line and we called on the research. But I do want to dig a little bit into the research. Bob, you were talking earlier about other jurisdictions, about Scotland, that has used catch and release to effectively increase and conserve and even grow their salmon population. And I know that there are some similar stories here in Newfoundland and Labrador. I know Igloo Lake, when you talked earlier about trout, I know Igloo Lake has successfully implemented a catch and release only program at their lodge.
Yes, and Menapee Lake did it many years ago.
Right, so
exactly
I mean,
the same reason.
For trout, yeah.
Yes, and for exactly the same reason, because you know, they felt that by taking out large trout out of the population, they were going to end up with essentially undermining the whole stock in the lakes and so on that they fish. Mm-hmm. So catch and release is a management tool that they could apply directly by choice. You know, they, I mean, it's nothing. There's nothing in the rules and regulations that require catch and release for trout. But these guys, the camp operators and so on, did that, and it's been a wonderful marketing tool for them. To get into these lodges, you sometimes have to wait for somebody else to, you know, stop fishing for whatever reason, in order just to get in there.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so, and I know that catch and release doesn't seem to, like you said, in Ireland or in Scotland, and now here, catch and release doesn't seem to deter fishermen from coming and from enjoying the actual experience of fishing. So, Steve, you know, I guess in your travels up and down the Eastern Seaboard and in the research that ASF does, you see catch and release being used as a conservation tool all over.
We see it being used as a conservation tool all over. We also see it as a choice that anglers have for how they choose to fish. And so I think you're talking about catch and release. I think it's only fair to also talk about whether we can have harvest fisheries that can contribute to conservation in some way, and I believe that they can. So I'm a little bit uncomfortable just about talking about catch and release and the benefits of it. People listening may think that that's the only way to achieve conservation, or that's what we're aiming for, and that's not the case. And that's why people get upset about it in Newfoundland and Labrador, I believe, because when people talk about the benefits of catch and release, oftentimes the importance of harvest to people also gets lost in the equation. And, you know, in Newfoundland and Labrador, it's a recreational fishery, and people have the choice how they use that fishery. They can take fish home or they cannot. But for a lot of people, bringing that fish home to eat is a part of the recreational experience. And so that's sometimes people see catch and release as a threat. I think we do need to be careful about focusing too much on catch and release without acknowledging that the harvest part of the fishery can be important to people, and it can be important for conservation, for keeping people on the rivers as well.
That's a great point, Steve, and you're absolutely right. I think, you know, when we do talk about catch and release, it's often because here in Newfoundland and Labrador, it does meet some resistance. But I think that is partially because we do have both of these types of fishery, both of these types of fishing often existing within the same fishermen, you know. So it's sometimes it's a conflict within themselves even, or on a river, that you see people consuming. But I think for the most part, on the river itself, no one would really look at you one way or another if you catch and release a salmon or if you catch and keep a salmon. We have tags. We have a system that allows us, thankfully, here still in Newfoundland and Labrador, to be able to consume. There is nothing like a fresh meal of salmon from a river. It's a beautiful experience. Like you said, Stephen, it is definitely a part of that recreational idea of the fishery, and it's a part of the experience, and it's a part of the cultural experience. And I think that, for the most part, that exists on a river level, and I wonder why it doesn't exist behind the scenes, and why do people pit each other against, or pit themselves against each other? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it does happen on the river from time to time. I've had some comments from folks from time to time, but you know, I think it's much easier to be sort of nasty to each other when you're on social media or, you know, on the radio, and you're not sort of face to face. And I think on the river, most people are pretty good about being tolerant of what other people are doing, even if they may not like it. I think the reason why it's so controversial, as I said before, is some people see catch and release as a threat to their way of fishing, and they don't feel sometimes in the discussion about how we can best achieve sustainable fisheries that the role of harvest is given its fair due. And so I think a lot of people feel the only way to defend their values around harvest is to push back, and to push back against catch and release. And I think that whole argument that we've been hearing over the last few weeks, well, last few years really, I think it's so counterproductive for conservation, because in Newfoundland and Labrador, we have much bigger problems with salmon than the recreational fishery. And anglers fighting with each other over who's got priority to the fish is distracting us from the bigger problems. And really, what we need to do is accept that both types of fishing are acceptable, and we should be aiming to have both types of fishing whenever we can, and get anglers focused on the real issues that are likely to affect salmon populations in the future.
Definitely. So, Bob, how do you feel about that? Is it something you agree with, that this is sort of an issue that comes up from time to time, and it's something that we definitely should talk about but not focus on necessarily?
I would agree 100%. I mean, the thing is, the vast majority of Newfoundland anglers do release fish. Even I would say the majority who would describe themselves as retention anglers, because number one, if they catch a fish that's over 63 centimeters, a large fish, they have to release it. You know, that's the law. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if I'm a retention angler and I catch a fish that's 52 or 53 centimeters long, I'm probably going to release that in hopes of getting one 58 or 59 centimeters long. I mean, there's an awful lot of that goes on, and there's nothing illegal about it, and there's nothing wrong with it if people want to do that. I mean, you see it on the Newfoundland Sportsman Show all the time. It's perfectly legal, and I say absolutely nothing wrong with it. So I think catch and release, as we've said, is a tool. That's nothing more. It's a management measure. And it's interesting, actually, because DFO some years ago, as part of the Salmon Advisory Committee meetings, did a total review of all the existing catch and release studies that have been done, and they include the studies on attitudes and preferences and so on. And they summed it up as catch and release as a management tool. It requires education and proper practices, but it needs to recognize the diversity in the angling population, including attitudes, preferences, motives, and satisfaction. And I think our current management regime does exactly that. You know, we have the option to release fish, but we also have the option to retain fish. And the majority of rivers in Newfoundland are reasonably healthy. You know, this, we're facing a lot of challenges, as Steve mentioned, and I'll get to in a moment. But the fact remains that we do have a lot of quite healthy rivers that can easily sustain a certain harvest, a percentage of harvest. And it would be nice if DFO was able to do more studies in more rivers and refine their allowances, their, you know, harvest allowances and so on a bit further. But, you know, we have what we have, and given the current financial situations around the country and so on, I doubt if we're going to get much more. But I think it provides a very reasonable balance between the retention angler on one hand and the catch and release angler on the other. And I would suggest to you that there are very, very few pure catch and release anglers in Newfoundland and Labrador. It's not our history. It's not our culture.
No, that's right. You know, and it is something people, it's something maybe that is coming, I think, from other jurisdictions into Newfoundland. I don't know many, like you said, many serious Newfoundland local anglers who are 100% catch and release. My dad has been fishing on rivers since he was able to cast, and he loves to fill his tags. If he's lucky enough to fill his tags, and that's the thing, you don't get out as often as you used to. So the face of salmon fishing is changing. The environment is changing so much. The work that you guys do together as organizations is helping us to think bigger about this. And we're going to get more into that in just a little bit. And I also want to talk about, we've been talking so much about how to catch and release safely and how to ensure that these salmon do have that chance to live long, healthy, spawning lives. And so I'd like to get both of your input into how we should be doing that and where people can find some more information about that. So we're going to be right back after this on the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.
Now let's get back to the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.
Welcome back for the Outdoor Hour. I'm Leslie Ann Corrigan, and we're actually talking salmon fishing here in January, of all things. But it has been a hot-button topic over the past few days, and it is something that's very important to the culture and community here in Newfoundland and Labrador. But I really am. I'm looking out my window here in Whitless Bay as we're recording for the weekend, and we're celebrating the weekend of Snowmageddon, and the thought that maybe that would be the only crazy thing that would happen in 2020. Boy, were we wrong. But I did enjoy the snow after it fell last year, so I am hoping that we'll get a little bit more to play in over the next little while, and I'm going to get up to some more adventures. So stay tuned to our Facebook page, and I'll let you know what I'm up to, and I would love for you to let me know what you're up to. If you're out enjoying the snow, send along some photos and let me know what you're at. I'm always looking for ideas for the show, so do get in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. We've got a Facebook page. It's VOCM Outdoor Hour. So as I mentioned on the show today, we are talking salmon fishing. I've brought in the Atlantic Salmon Federation's Dr. Steve Sutton and Bob Bishop of Stain to talk about the importance of angling and also catch and release as a tool and to get some information and data out there on this practice. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about how important this is to people, this fishery. And as we talked about, Steve, about having people on the river. So why do you think that that's most important? You both mentioned that having people actually on the river is an important conservation tool. Let's get into that.
Well, I think having people on the river is important. Having that presence on the river is a deterrent for poachers. You know, if there's any problems on the river, people doing the wrong thing, you know, those reports often, almost always come from anglers, actually. But more generally, I think just having the recreational fishery itself is really important for salmon conservation, because the people who care about salmon are the ones who push governments to do the right thing. They're the ones who are defending salmon. If we didn't have a recreational fishery for salmon in Newfoundland, I don't think we would have any salmon left, because there wouldn't be enough people left who care about them to get DFO in the province doing the things they do. People talk about the number of counting facilities that we have in Newfoundland and Labrador, and sometimes people say, well, we don't have enough, and that's probably true. But at the same time, if we didn't have a recreational fishery, we probably wouldn't have any of those. If we didn't have a recreational fishery, we wouldn't have a team of dedicated salmon scientists at DFO who are trying to look out for the resource. If we didn't have a recreational fishery, we would have hydro dams on the Upper Humber River, on Main River, on Northwest River in Terra Nova Park, and probably a bunch of other rivers too. So having that fishery and the social and economic benefits that it brings is really important for salmon conservation, because it keeps people connected to the resource, keeps people caring about the resource. And so we need to keep that in mind when we're making decisions about how do we manage the fishery, because fisheries management decisions that disconnect people from the fishery and from salmon are likely to be counterproductive in the long term.
Right, and it is very important to think long-term about this, because we are experiencing fluctuations in our environment. There's lots of things that longer-term we should be considering, because we're losing control, I think, over these variables that we should be able to control more and more. So, Bob, as Steve mentioned, it's the people on the rivers that matter. It's the people on the rivers that are driving the science. And I guess that's true with your group as well. You're basically a group of anglers, as you mentioned.
We are. We also have some people, scientists, active scientists, whether at the university or in other employment, but they are, salmon biologists and so on, currently working. I mean, my biological experience is over 40 years ago now, but, the basics are still there. The only thing, and I think Steve did a wonderful job of summarizing why we need people on the rivers, and the only thing I could add to that is that, there are all kinds of other things that can go on rivers as well, not directly related to fishing, but pollution incidents, wrong construction practices for woods, roads, and so on. There are pretty strict regulations about how these things are supposed to be built, and with nobody there looking at it, sometimes people cut corners. And again, it's usually anglers that report these things.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's anglers and it's other people who are in the woods, in the deep woods, in the wilderness for whatever reason. And we want those people to be in there for good reasons and to be using it and to be stewards of the environment. And I think, like you say, the more people, it's not like you're going to be opening up highways in there by encouraging people to get out angling, but the more people who are involved, I think definitely the better. I've said it and I've met on this show and throughout all my career here in the outdoor industry that all of the best conservationists, all of the groups are driven by hunters and anglers, depending on whatever that they're interested in. It is in their best interest from a business point of view, because oftentimes they start businesses and work in the outdoor industry that they're so passionate about. But also from a particularly cultural standpoint, it is very important to be able to be out and to participate in these traditional fisheries. And Steve, you mentioned with the First Nations communities that are so much stewards of the environment. I know that there's been an awful lot of science done on Conn River in particular about the sustainability of the fishery.
Indeed. Conn River is in big trouble. They only had a few hundred fish come back last year, so the recreational fishery is closed. The First Nations fishery has long been closed, and the First Nation down there made that decision to move away from that fishery and to focus more on angling fishery for conservation reasons. So, and that was a long time ago they made that decision. Unfortunately, in the case of Conn River, it does not appear that it was either fishery, recreational or indigenous, that was the problem. The issue we believe down there is the impact of aquaculture. And that's an issue that is not being addressed adequately. And again, you need anglers. We need anglers and First Nations together working on that.
Right, absolutely. And we're going to talk more about the effects of that later in the show. But I think getting back to our initial topic and our sort of reason for being here today is catch and release is something that I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to get the facts and data out there. And both of you have mentioned, and it's something that we hear come up time and time again, that catch and release needs to be done well. And there is, I think, in my personal opinion, a bit of a disconnect between DFO's policies and its on-the-ground education in how to perform catch and release well so that you have a higher chance of survival. So I'm going to ask both of you for your sort of input on that, on how to effectively release that salmon. But I wonder if either of you sort of has an opinion on that as well, that maybe we should be educating more. As you both mentioned, 63 centimeters and up, we have to be releasing these salmon. So it is important to know how to do it well. Do you think DFO is sort of falling down on that job?
Well, I think they've sort of left it to the conservation community originally to define and set out the best practices. I mean, the best practices come from a lot of the research that's been done on catch and release and the effects on mortality and so on. But I will say they are catching up. I mean, the Angler's Guide the last few years has contained a direct link to a video illustrating best practices. At Sane, we've done our own video, which is available on our website, showing best practices for catch and release. And there are numerous others on YouTube and other platforms on the Internet. As well, the Angler's Guide, even before the connection, the link to a video and so on, the actual best practices were laid out, in print. So there's really no excuse for people not to know, what the best practices are.
Mm-hmm. And so what are they, Bob? What are the best practices? I know we're going to post a link up, of course, to your website. But for our listeners here today, what are the main things that you want to remember when releasing a salmon?
Okay, first off, our regulations require only a single hook, barbless. That's all you're allowed to use. And so that does two things, actually. It saves the lives of tens of thousands of pair every year, but it also makes it easier to remove the hook when you are successful. But in terms of best practices, when you hook a fish, get it in quickly. Don't be playing it for any length of time. To get it in quickly. Trying to avoid handling it as much as possible. I know as many people these days are using specifically designed catch-and-release nets that avoid the kind of damage that the old knotted cotton nets used to inflict on the fish. But try and handle it as little as possible. Get the hook out with using either just your fingers or a pair of forceps, and remove the hook. And then revive the fish. And again, don't hold it tightly. Don't lift it out of the water. Keep it in the water all the time. Have with a loose grip around the tail and support it under the belly, up close to the pectoral fins, facing into the water. You don't want to be trying to revive a fish in some quiet backwater. You want to get it out with its current, because the fish needs water moving past its gills in order to breathe and recover. And look after it. Just stay with it until it is strong enough and swims away on its own.
Mm-hmm. And so, Steve, anything that you can add to that? I think that's a pretty comprehensive rundown of best practices. I know that water temperature is key to salmon survival. That's something that I see coming up again and again.
It is, and I think Bob gave a very good overview, as you said, of the things that anglers can do when they're releasing a fish to ensure its survival. But the science has also shown that water temperature is very important. Salmon get uncomfortable at higher temperatures. They become stressed at water temperatures over about 20, 21 degrees. And they do not handle the stress of catch and release very well, or as well, over 20 degrees. So it's very difficult for anglers to sort of know, what the water temperature is. You can measure it, and some anglers do carry thermometers, but in general, the way that impact is managed is by DFO, and they have brought in some new water temperature protocols in the last couple of years, where at 20 degrees, the river's closed to morning angling only. And it's morning angling only because that's when the water temperature is expected to be coolest, after overnight. And so that's another way of ensuring that that mortality from live release, catch and release, is minimized by not having anglers out on the rivers catching salmon when the water is too high, too hot, and when their chances of dying are increased. And so that's another thing. Anglers can do that by checking the water temperature, but we also need to be supportive of those sorts of water temperature protocols, because if we are going to have a sustainable fishery, we have to be doing those sorts of things to minimize the impacts of our activities.
That's right, and I think that's important. That's a key message for everyone who's listening today and everyone who ever wants to take part in a fishery or a hunt or anything like that. The rules and regulations are there for a reason. They're typically very well researched, and they have been put in place, as you mentioned, as conservation so that we can do this for a long time. So follow the rules and get the information. If you're going to be doing this, find out how to do it well and do it right, and you'll have more fun. And we always say that, safety and best practices, and you'll just enjoy yourself more. So we're enjoying ourselves here, as always, on the Outdoor Hour. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking again with Atlantic Salmon Federation and the Salmonid Association of Eastern Newfoundland. I'm Leslie Ann Corrigan, and this is your VOCM.
Now let's get back to the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Hour. I'm Leslie Ann Corrigan, and we're in the home stretch. We're in the fourth quarter. I'm always amazed at how fast the show goes and how often I wish I had more time to chat with my guests. So the good news about it is that most people who I talk to are more than happy to talk about the thing that drives them, whether it's as a career or through a personal hobby and passion. And there's so many community groups that are so eager to talk to me and share the information and knowledge that they have. So I'm grateful, and I'm grateful to my guests today. I'm here with Dr. Steve Sutton from Atlantic Salmon Federation and Bob Bishop from SANE. And we are talking salmon here in the winter, but it's something that we should be talking about, that lots of people are talking about right now. And we have been talking about catch and release. We did mention that the best practices to release a salmon, and that we all have to do that. Even if you are a retention angler, of course, you're expected to release a salmon over 63 centimeters. So I'm going to post up on the Facebook page some links to videos that the gentleman mentioned that will help you do this well and do it correctly. If you're new to angling, or if something that you should always kind of keep refreshed on, there's always scientists out in the field who are rediscovering new ways and better practices and coming up with policies that help us. So it's good to keep on top of things for sure. So keep in touch with us and I will help you out. And so we were talking a little bit earlier, Steve, we touched on some other pressures. Like you said, angling isn't something that has caused the issues that they're having in places like Conn River. It didn't cause really what they're experiencing all over the South Coast. So there are other major pressures that we're dealing with and we're fighting against, I guess you could say. What are some of the major ones for you?
Well, just to put it into context, the thing that we believe is causing the big fluctuations in our salmon populations that we've seen over the past few years is low survival in the marine environment. And that is believed to be caused by our old friend climate change and changes that are resulting in the ocean. And so our salmon, our juvenile salmon, are going to sea, and they're not surviving to this at the same rate they used to. So that's kind of overlaying everything. And so that means that other human impacts on salmon or on marine survival or even on freshwater production, the impacts are magnified because the ocean is not as productive for salmon as it used to be. And so you mentioned the South Coast, and I mentioned it earlier. You know, we've got the aquaculture industry down there. That industry has been growing down there since the 1990s. In Bay de Spear, Conn River has been going, the salmon population in Conn River has been going down in conjunction with the rise of the aquaculture industry. We have governments, both levels of governments, who seem to be quite happy to let that happen. The province wants nothing to do with regulating the industry for the environmental effects, and DFO, whose job it is to manage the environmental impacts of aquaculture, seem to be missing in action and are unwilling to step in and put better regulation on the industry. So that's something that we, all of us together, need to be concerned about, whether you're a catch and release angler or a retention angler or both. And, you know, the arguments that we have with each other are taking our attention away from things like that.
And so at the moment, so those salmon stocks on the south coast of Newfoundland have been assessed as threatened about 8 or 10 years ago. DFO has indicated that they are this year going to make a decision as to whether to actually list those stocks as threatened. And if that happens, the entire south coast of Newfoundland, all those rivers, St. Mary's Bay, all the way over to Codroy, just before Codroy, they'll all be closed to recreational angling, despite the fact that most of those rivers probably don't meet the criteria for being listed as threatened. And we see that as a big threat to salmon conservation for the reasons I mentioned earlier, because it will take people off of those rivers, probably permanently, and there will be nobody left to care about those rivers. There'll be nobody left to fight against the expansion of the aquaculture industry down there. So we see that as a major issue that's coming. And if people, anglers in Newfoundland, don't sort of get educated about what's possibly going to happen down there, we could lose access to the entire south coast of Newfoundland for recreational angling.
That's an incredible statement, and I don't know if people can sort of feel the weight of that as you say it. It is, as you both mentioned, the salmon anglers who notice the things that are happening, because they're the ones that are on the rivers, and they're going to notice, you know, despite these catch and release and other conservation tools that are working in other jurisdictions, that they just don't seem to be working in the South Coast. So what else is happening? And they know, and I think that that's something that we all need to be mindful of, is that this is a bigger picture. So, Bob, I know your organization has been very vocal about its opposition to open pen aquaculture, the way it is currently operated here in Newfoundland and Labrador. Obviously, it's a big issue for you folks. So what would, you know, your membership, how would they think of this closure of mass amount of rivers in Newfoundland?
Well, I think they'd be absolutely appalled. First, because it's come to the point where that's, you know, even DFO considers it necessary. I think there'd be a lot of discussion around how necessary it is to, say, take the entire south coast. I mean, that's the only reason they would do that, and Steve, correct me if I'm wrong on this, is because they've divided up the province into various management areas. And they're not looking at doing something like this on a targeted basis. You know, if you're seriously looking at threatened, you'd look at Conn River and Little River, which both flow into Bay de Spear, and which is where the aquaculture has been concentrated, and possibly some of the rivers on either side of Bay de Spear, where aquaculture has been expanding in recent years. But again, that would need to be based on some good data, accounting data and so on, in those rivers. I think every one of our members, and probably every fisherman on the island, would be absolutely appalled at this idea. You know, there are certainly, like I say, there are certainly rivers that are in danger. But, you know, let's just talk about those, not spread the net, so to speak, that wide. But overall, I think the biggest issue is that aquaculture is being expanded. The provincial government has been derelict by not requiring the proper environmental impact studies. And even when the studies are done and quite clearly show the negative impacts of aquaculture on wild fish, they just ignore it and carry on anyway. And, I mean, we only have to look anywhere where open pen salmon aquaculture takes place, adjacent to wild salmon rivers, the wild salmon disappear. It's happened in the Bay of Fundy, it's happened in Bay de Spear, it's happened in Ireland, it's happened on the west coast of Scotland, and it's happened in Norway. I mean, it's to the point now in Norway, as licenses expire, like they license each site over there individually, and they charge a lot of money for it, by the way, and we give it away. They're closing down a lot of those sites, and essentially the only new licenses they're issuing or reissuing are in areas away from salmon rivers. Yeah, so they'll go to fjords or bays that don't have salmon rivers running into them, which is why the Norwegians are over here and in Chile and other places in the world. I mean, the Norwegian companies dominate the salmonid aquaculture.
And so as their license expire in their own home countries, they are not being able to renew them. So that's why they're coming, you know, instead of exploring, you know, these companies, I guess, are open pen companies. So instead of exploring this new on land based aquaculture, they are just sort of moving to places that will take them.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, this is, you know, and again, this is probably a personal perspective. I think that this is a dying industry. You know, that we're going to see probably more of it in the short term, but in the long term, they're going to lose the market because what's happening with the on land aquaculture for salmon and steelhead trout as well is that there are huge onshore plants being built quite right adjacent to their main markets. So there's huge plants being built in New England, in the U.S., for the East Coast of the U.S. There's a big plant, Kansas City or somewhere like that, right in the center of the U.S. That's in the planning stage. You know, so they'll be going from having to get fish harvested here, cleaned, and then transported for, you know, 2 or 3 days to get to these markets, to be able to go from out of the water in the morning and in the supermarket in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Awfully short-sighted, and as you mentioned, you know, it seems our government is notoriously short-sighted, especially when it comes to environmental issues. I know, it always baffles me because just from a personal perspective, if you as a homeowner had a leaky oil tank, the amount of red tape and environmental assessments and things that you have to go through, it seems to be, you know, absolutely insurmountable. But yet, you can get away with anything, it seems, if you're going to be bringing a few jobs to a rural community. And that is wrong. I honestly, you know, perhaps I shouldn't be sharing my opinion so blatantly here on the show, but it's an opinion that I have that's backed by data. And I think that that's the important thing to remember when we're talking about catch and release, when we're talking about aquaculture, when we're talking about anything that affects our environment, is the science matters and the facts matter. And it's on us. It's imperative that we all get some information and get educated about it. So I hope that both of you are going to continue to share, educate us all on it, and that I hope we've brought some information and education to some of our listeners today. I am going to post up some links on our Facebook page for both of the groups, as well as some of the data that I looked into to research the show today. It's all readily available, and that's the thing. You can find out how much the impacts are affecting us all and this major cultural resource. It's a business, it's an industry, but it's a part of who we are. So I want to thank my guests very much for joining me today, Dr. Steve Sutton from Atlantic Salmon Federation and Bob Bishop from the Salmonid Association of Eastern Newfoundland. Thank you both.
Okay, you're quite welcome. Before we go, do I have time for one last comment?
Absolutely.
Just on that, the endangered species listing for the South Coast, the Atlantic Salmon Federation, as I said, we're very concerned about what that might mean for the recreational fishery and conservation. So we've just launched a website. It's called peopleforsalmon, all one word, .com. And for people who are interested in learning more about the process and what may potentially happen down on the South Coast, you can go there and you can get information on what the process will be and how people can get engaged to let the government know their opinions.
Excellent. I love it. So we'll post that link as well on our Facebook page. Thanks again, gentlemen. It's been a great chat, as always. This is Leslie Ann Corrigan for the Outdoor Hour on your VOCM.